Back in the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan was president, and for many of the young people, they're going, who? That long ago? Well, the story's important, not when it happened. There was a labor secretary named Raymond Donovan. Anybody remember that name? Raymond Donovan was Secretary of Labor, and he was accused of fraud. He was not just accused, he was indicted. And the issue behind the accusation was he had belonged to a company and was part of a company that had leased some equipment to another company who was given a contract by the Labor Department. Okay? Could have been a copier. I'm not sure what it was. But at any rate, because of the charges of fraud, he and a number of others were brought to trial, and every single one of them was acquitted. Every single one of them was found not guilty. And as he was leaving the courthouse, a reporter asked him if he had any comment to make. And with an angry, defiant look, he made the following now famous comment. Yes. What office do I go to get back my reputation? His name had been run through the mud. He had lost his job by false accusations. And his question was, what office do I go to get my reputation back? Because he realized that more than anything else, his reputation meant the most to him. I wonder if Joseph asked that question during all those years. How do I get my reputation back? I wonder if he asked that question. But what is incredibly encouraging is that he got his reputation back and so much more. So much more. Rising above adversity, lessons from the life of Joseph. This will be the last time we will look at the kinds of adversity he faced, because we're going to be going to the rising above part. Isn't that refreshing? But just a reminder, the first adversity he faced was he came from a dysfunctional family heritage. In all the lying and the scheming and the deception and the sibling rivalries and the hatred within the family, all that. The second adversity he faced was the death of his mother. The death of his mother. At a young age. The third adversity was being the favorite and how that went against him, which led to the fourth adversity. He was hated and betrayed and abandoned by his brothers. The fifth adversity was that he was attacked, his integrity was attacked by Potiphar's wife. And Greg shared something with me this morning I hadn't thought of, but it's just so obvious. You know, we did mention that Potiphar didn't believe his wife. A very obvious thing would have been if Potiphar's wife's story had been true, if Joseph had tried to rape her, her clothes would have been in his hands and not the other way around. Just a thought, but I just found that interesting. The sixth adversity was that he was in prison, falsely accused, and then he had his hopes raised when he told the dream of the butler or cupbearer and the baker was released. The butler was released, but the baker was not. And he told the butler, remember me before Pharaoh because I have been falsely accused. As we think about the story of Joseph, I really would retitle today's sermon. I would call it Joseph's Secret for Rising Above Adversity. Joseph's Secrets for Rising Above Adversity. When you think about it, what gave him the secrets? And in his book on Joseph, Chuck Swindoll mentions that during this time between age of 17 when he was thrown into the pit and then sold for slavery and the time in which he was released at the age of 30, that God was using these things to refine Joseph's character. Joseph most likely was praying for release and it didn't come. at least not immediately, but God was using these adverse things, these unfair things, these unjust things, these unasked for things, these painful, hurtful things that broke him. He was using them to refine Joseph's character. We need to keep that thought in mind. The second thing he was doing is he was preparing him for the work that Joseph would do one day. Remember what he did in Potiphar's house? He was put in charge of everything in Potiphar's house, and he did it with such integrity that Potiphar said he trusted everything to Joseph. He was teaching him how to rule over a household. A household in which the rest of the slaves had to obey him. They didn't have an option. Then when he was put in prison, which, by the way, was more than likely, if you didn't catch this, was more than likely a big room in a house next to Potiphar's house, he was once again put in charge of the entire prison. And prisoners, while they're supposed to obey, don't always obey those in charge. He would be dealing with a somewhat hostile environment, perhaps. And God is using this time. He's learning also about how things work in the government somewhat. He's got an ear. Some of the prisoners, most of those prisoners, would have been people who were there because they were there for political reasons. God's using these events to prepare him for his future and how he is going to use him to bless not just his own family, but all of Egypt as well. How does he do it? The story is familiar. The story is familiar. He does it first and foremost by refining his character, because all those tests revealed what his character was really like. There is a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. It says, "The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in the moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy." Certainly Joseph stood tall when he faced the challenges and the controversies in his life. Did he not? He did. So what were the secrets that enabled Joseph to arise above his adversities? Open your Bibles, if you will, to Genesis chapter 41. Genesis chapter 41. You remember the story well. I'm not going to take the entire time to read the story. Pharaoh has a dream, and in that dream, when he has the dream, first of all, he wakes up, but he doesn't, goes back to sleep and has another dream. In the first dream, there are seven cows. They come up out of the Nile. They are seven cows that are attractive and plump, and they feed in the reed grass, it says. And then seven other cows, ugly and thin, come up after those, and they eat up the seven plump cows, but their countenance isn't changed at all. In other words, the famine is worse than the time of plenty. And then he has another dream in which there are seven plump ears of grain, and they are eaten by the seven thin ears of grain. He wakens up, and he can't remember what it is. His spirit's troubled, and he calls for the magicians, and he tells them, "I can't remember my dream." And they said, "Tell us what the dream is." And they can't remember, nobody can do this. And then the baker remembers. He said, "Oops, Pharaoh, I'm going to confess my faults today. I promised somebody I would remember them when I came. There was a young man, a prisoner in the prison with me, and he interpreted the dream I had and that the butler had, and our dreams came too. His name is Joseph." And then it says, now notice verse 14. Notice what it says. It says that Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they quickly brought him out of the pit. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. I have heard it said of you that when you hear of a dream, you interpret it. Joseph answered Pharaoh, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. Now, before we talk about the clues as to how Joseph was able to rise above adversity, there are some things we just need to kind of go over a little bit. Some interesting sidelights to the story that help us understand the story a little bit more. I want you to notice the word in kind of an orange. He brought him out of the pit. Whenever you think about the story of Joseph, you think about him coming out of a pit of a prison. What's interesting is this. When it referred to the prison, when he was first thrown into it, it called it a house. That was a different word than this word is. When it referred to him being in the prison with the butler and the baker, it says they were in a house. When the baker was talking to Pharaoh and said, when I was in the prison, he didn't say pit, he said, when I was in the house. Why the change of words? Well, it's kind of interesting. It's really interesting because the word pit can be not a literal word, but it can be a figurative word. It can be a figurative word. We even use it that way today, don't we? He was in the pits. Nobody looks around to see where he'd fallen. Right? It means a difficult place. It means a time of challenge. It means a time when you're despondent, when you despair. It means down in the doldrums. But there's something else it means. It's used this way in other places. I will just use Zechariah 9:11 as a reference. We're not going to read it. But it talks about God's people being set free from the waterless pit. It is a word for deliverance from captivity. It is a word for deliverance from captivity. What it's really saying is when Pharaoh brings Joseph out of the pit, he is being set free. Do you catch the importance of that statement now? We bypass that so easily. It says he's calling him from his prison and he's going to set him free. Even before he tells the dream. And then notice what it says. When he had shaved himself and changed his clothes. No big deal, right? Except Hebrews didn't shave. Egyptians did. Joseph, in his wisdom, said, if I'm going to appear before the Egyptian Pharaoh, I better appear in a way that will not cause a problem. This small little detail is so often looked in the story. What it tells us about Joseph is Joseph, when he was in that prison, being prepared for his future work, he was learning the customs and the practices of the Egyptians. And he was putting it into practice. Greg shared with me, he just has shared a couple things recently, but Greg shared with me something. Come on up, Greg. You didn't know I was going to do this. Come on up. Talking about witnessing, and this is number 31, Mike. There's something you shared about witnessing, about intimacy. You want to share that from the book you've been reading? Trust, not intimacy, trust, right.
Ah.
Okay, had the wrong word.
Yes. So a thought sort of has come up as I've been reading this book about our witness has to be at the speed of trust. That as we work in the community, as we do evangelism, we can really go no faster than the relationship of trust that we have with the individual. John 10:5 says that my sheep hear and know my voice, and a stranger's voice they run away from. And it occurred to me that sometimes I go to people to try to witness to them, and I'm talking from my voice about truth and what they need to know, and I might sound like a stranger to them, because those people know Jesus' voice. The Bible says he does. And Jesus worked that way. He got people to trust him, and then he said, come and follow me. So, witness at the speed of trust. Okay.
I really like that. And I think that's exactly what Joseph was doing. By shaving, he was developing trust with Pharaoh. Do you get the point? He was a wise man. So Pharaoh says to Joseph, I've had a dream. There's no one who can interpret it. Now we get down to Joseph's secret for rising above adversity. I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream and when you, that you can interpret it. And Joseph answered Pharaoh and he said, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. Pharaoh says, I've heard you can do this. He's just brought him from the prison. I think the first inclination of most of us would have been said, got it. Let me tell you. It doesn't do that. In fact, in English, it doesn't really convey how he really answered. It is and not in me is 5 words. Short words, but 5 words. Joseph said it in 1. And he chose a word and he said it in such a way that there would be no question about what that he really meant it. It was almost as if he was cutting off Pharaoh and saying, don't look at me, Pharaoh. Not me, God. There are some connections and ties, and I'm still thinking this through, between Daniel and Pharaoh, Daniel and Joseph, I'm sorry. Daniel and Joseph and Nebuchadnezzar and Pharaoh. Every time you read in the story of Daniel, when somebody says to Daniel, can you? Daniel says, it's not me, there is a what? God in heaven, just like Joseph does. Every time he has a prayer, he pauses and thanks God for hearing his prayer. They both had a long time between when they prayed for something, when an answer was given. And they were both men of integrity. That's interesting. I'll have to study that more someday. But I want you to notice his immediate response, it is not in me. I do not think this is just about the dream he interpreted. I do not believe that it is not in me was just something that Joseph applied to this situation in which he's interpreting the Pharaoh's dream. I believe that when he was called to forgive his brothers, he recognized that the ability to forgive his brothers for what they had done was because it was not in him. It was a divine act of God. I believe when he was leading, acting as premier or governor or prime minister of Egypt, that when he was overseeing the collecting of the food and the disbursement of the food, he recognized that his leadership was not because merely his own talents and abilities, but that his leadership came about because it was not in him, but God who was in him. Do you catch the point? Joseph was so convinced, as we saw last week, that God's presence was with him in spite of everything he faced. He was so convinced of it that when he was confronted with challenges, when he was asked to interpret dreams, when he was asked to lead Egypt, every single thing he did, it all came down to this. It's not me, it's him. That's the secret to his rise above adversity. It's not me, it's him. Joseph had many reasons not to believe that to be true, did he not? My brothers betrayed me. But it's still about him. Potiphar's wife falsely accused me. I'm in prison and I don't deserve it. But it's not about me, it's about him. Whatever we go through in life, if we would remember that in spite of whatever, there is still a God on his throne who uses those events and those adverse situations to refine us and to prepare us, to refine our characters and to prepare our witness, to refine our characters to prepare our ways of serving others, that God uses those things, and it may not happen today, it may not happen tomorrow, it might come to fruition down the road. Do you catch the point of his secret? It's not in me. It doesn't stop there. I want you to notice how many times, I think we missed one, I don't know what happened. Okay, it is this one. I want you to notice what happens after he interprets the dream for Pharaoh. Pharaoh says to Joseph, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he's about to do. Joseph wants to make certain that Pharaoh doesn't take his interpretation of dream and give him credit. Joseph wants to make certain that even though he gave the dream and it came out of his mouth, that Pharaoh gets it, that it wasn't Joseph, the former prisoner. It was the God who was with Joseph when he was in prison. Joseph doesn't stop talking about God before Pharaoh. Verse 41:28. It is as I told Pharaoh, God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. It's about God again. Verse 32. And the doubling of Pharaoh's dream, meaning two dreams, means that the thing is fixed by God and God will shortly bring it about. God's behind it all. God's taking care of it all. Don't focus on me and what I say, Pharaoh. Focus on God and what God says and what God's doing. What's really interesting is what takes place next. Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? Now, we don't recognize how really incredible that statement is by Pharaoh. We have a hard time figuring out what it would mean for Pharaoh to make that statement about Joseph. There were over 25 main gods in Egypt. They all had various powers, and sometimes they crossed over. Pharaoh himself was not just a god, he was the ultimate god. Pharaoh himself was God. They worshiped the Nile. They worshiped the god of the sky. They worshiped the god of the air. They worshiped the god of the river. They worshiped the god of, you name it. They worshiped the scarab beetle. Anybody ever hear of this before? The scarab beetle is commonly referred to as the dung beetle. They laid their larvae in the dung of the cattle, who also, by the way, were gods. And when the larvae would come to life, they would roll the dung into a ball, and it would help fertilize the crops. So the dung beetle was the god of creation. Anybody want to have a dung beetle for their god this morning? I put my hand down real quick. But Pharaoh was the top god. When Pharaoh says, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? He's acknowledging that Joseph's God is greater even than he himself. Now, that doesn't mean he gave up his idolatry, because the word for God is the word Elohim. He uses Joseph's word for God. Eloi is the singular for God. Elohim is the plural for God. In the story of creation, it says, in the beginning, God, in the English Bible, it literally reads in Hebrew, in the beginning, gods created the heaven and the earth, meaning the Trinity. For Pharaoh to hear this story of Joseph's God who could interpret dreams, he could just simply put that in his pantheon of gods and say, I can believe in your God, but I'm going to hold on to my God too. And aren't you glad that God's gracious enough to give people room to work through those things? That's just a sidelight. But that does not take away from the fact that Pharaoh was saying Joseph's God could interpret the dream he couldn't even remember. Think about that for a second. Joseph's God could interpret the dream that Pharaoh couldn't even remember, let alone interpret. What an admission. It doesn't end there. Pharaoh says to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you. Pharaoh understands that Joseph's abilities His ability to discern and his wisdom were not the result of Joseph's own innate talents, but that those abilities came from Joseph's God. Listen, my friends, my fellow members, listen very carefully. Modern man thinks modern man is the answer to modern man's problems. And we aren't at first base. Listen, fellow Christians, in the Christian life, we often think that our answers to our walk with God and to becoming more like God and to do what God asks is to be found in our backbone and in our strong wills and in our ability to simply change. We think that we cannot witness because we don't have the right skills. We think we can witness because we do have the right skills. We focus on ourselves instead of recognizing that there is a God who can do exceedingly abundantly above all that we could ask or think, and who has called us to serve him to help others know the kind of God he is. I want you to notice one more point. After it's all over, Joseph's exonerated. After it's all over, Joseph's exonerated. But I want you to notice something that takes place. He's exonerated. He marries a woman named Aseneth. And by the way, the last part of her name is the goddess, one of the goddesses. And Joseph was given a name that meant one of the goddesses. And Joseph calls the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. The word Manasseh means to forget. And then he names the second one Ephraim, which means God has made me, and Ephraim means double fruitful in the land of my affliction. This is the second key to his secret for rising above adversity. He remembers and says, God enables me to forget the past. He enables me to forget the wrongs done to me. He enables me to forgive. He enables me to treat others even though in ways they don't deserve, even though they've mistreated me. He's enabled me to see beyond what they've done to me. He's enabled me to see what they can do for God. I want you to think about something that's so obvious that I couldn't believe I never saw it before. If you want to know how much he was able to forget, when he was given the signet ring, which meant he had all kinds of authority and power, he had the power to put anybody in prison he wanted to. He had the power to say that they're going to be executed. I would like to have been a little mouse in Potiphar's house when Potiphar and his wife heard that Joseph was now second in command. Do you catch that? If Joseph operated the way Potiphar's wife did, she wouldn't have stood a chance to live another day. Right? We don't know what happened to Potiphar's wife, but there are a number, and you can go online and look at them, there are a number of stories where people wrote things about Potiphar's wife to try and finish the story about her and to show that maybe it wasn't as bad an ending as we might think it might be. But the point I'm trying to make is this. The forgiveness, the forgetting, was not just forgetting about what happened in his family. The forgetting was about the hardships, the false accusations. He's saying, I will not hold what took place against me against the person who did it. And that was not in him any more than it was the ability to interpret a dream. It was a divine thing. And then he says, God has made me fruitful. God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. God has restored me. God has blessed me. God has overruled all those who meant evil for me. Do you see the secret to rising above his adversity? If Joseph had wallowed in his misery, he would never have been put in charge in Potiphar's house. If Joseph had become angry and bitter at the mistreatment of his brothers and Potiphar's wife, he would never have been put in charge of Potiphar's prison. If Joseph had remained angry and bitter, God could not have used him to interpret the dreams of the butler and baker. In short, if Joseph had remained bitter and angry, if he had not been forgiving, he would never have become the second in the kingdom of Egypt, and his name would not be written in this book. God has made me fruitful. Took 13 years, but he did it. In speaking about Joseph's life, Ellen White in Patriarchs and Prophets makes the following statement. The same fidelity to God was manifest when he stood in the palace of the Pharaohs as when in a prisoner's cell. He was still a stranger in a heathen land, separated from his kindred, the worshipers of God, but he fully believed that the divine hand had directed his steps. And in constant reliance upon God, he faithfully discharged the duties of his position. Through Joseph, the attention of the king and great men of Egypt was directed to the true God, that stated in Psalm 105. And though they adhered to their idolatry, they learned to respect the principles revealed in the life and character of the worshiper of Jehovah. I want you to notice that last sentence and want to connect it with what Greg said. Witnessing is done at the speed of trust. They may not learn to accept everything we try to share with them immediately, but if they see God at work in our life and in our characters, they will appreciate the God we worship and serve too. So how does it end for Joseph? He's exonerated. Sorry for the picture. I didn't realize it was so fuzzy. He's exonerated. Obviously, he was released from prison. And when he was released, he was given a golden necklace. History tells us, archaeology tells us, that the golden necklaces were given by the pharaohs as an act of gratitude. It was a medal of gratitude that somebody would be given to thank them for a work of service, extraordinary work of service they'd done for the pharaoh. It wasn't just another mere necklace bought at the local jewelry store or fashioned by the jeweler of the palace. It was a necklace of honor. He was installed as the governor or prime minister. We also fail to realize the significance of that. In those days, the ruler of a nation would never give his an important position like that to a person from another country. They didn't want to risk assassinations and coups. I guarantee you that some of Pharaoh's court, some of the key leaders, had to have questioned Pharaoh and said, "Are you sure you want this done? Do you know where he came from? He's a Hebrew. Don't you remember what happened to Potiphar's wife? Bringing up old stuff." He's placed as second in the kingdom. He rides in the second chariot. There's no question that he is placed in a place of prominence with Pharaoh. He's given a signet ring. We've already talked about that. He could perform any authority for Pharaoh unless Pharaoh denied it. Whatever he commanded had to take place. I referred to his name. I'm not going to try to pronounce it and twist my tongue all over the place. But his name means, according to some, the God who speaks and lives. Wow. A foreign king, an idolatrous king, a king who is called God by his citizenry, gives him a new name, and Joseph becomes, in his eyes, the God who speaks and lives. Why? Because he recognized that the God who lives was living in Joseph. And the God who spoke to him spoke through Joseph. And the God who was there was there through Joseph. And then he was given two sons. He was given two sons, and their names were the story of Joseph's life. He forgot what was behind, as Paul said, and he pressed forward to the high calling of God. In 2 weeks, because we have communion next week, in 2 weeks we're going to look at that long, long section in which Joseph is dealing with his brothers. Read it before you come. I can't cover it all. But I want to make one point about preparing for the famine. For Pharaoh to believe Joseph that there was a famine that was going to last 7 years took an enormous amount of faith. I think God gave Pharaoh the gift of faith to believe Moses. I do. Because you see, in Egypt, famines didn't last that long because of the Nile River. In Egypt, the Nile River had so much water that they had enough irrigation to take care of any drought that might take place over a year or two. But a famine of 7 years was unheard of. And to prepare for a famine of 7 years during seven prosperous years would go against the grain of the human mind and heart. Let me make money while I can. Let me get as much grain set aside as I can. Let me see if I can use this grain for more crops and get a bigger acreage so I can make more. Do you see the point? What I'm trying to suggest to you this morning is the very fact that Pharaoh listened to Joseph and put him in place so that he could oversee the storing up of grain for 7 years to prepare for the famine was also an act of God for him to believe the dream Joseph interpreted. Joseph had risen above his adversity. Joseph had been brought out of the pit of despondency and despair, and he was raised to a seat in the government to save a nation of idolaters, as well as his own family, as those who are worshipers of God. Listen, my friends, someone else came up out of the pit. And it wasn't his own pit. It was a pit called a tomb. Someone else came out of the pit of the tomb so that you and I could be restored to a place in God's kingdom. And when he came out of that grave, he called us out of the pits of our despondency, the pits of our despair, the pits of our hopelessness, the pits of our trying times. He's called us out of that, and he's told us, "My grace is sufficient for you." And he will work in your life if you allow him to. Far more than we do, we need to look for ways God is at work in our lives so that we may share how God is working in our lives with others. So that we, like Joseph and Daniel, and even Jesus himself, can say, "Don't look at me, there is a God in heaven. And he knows. And he knows you. And he knows your future. And your future is secure because he rose from the pit of a grave to call you from the pits that come and take place in your lives so that you can reign with him forever when he comes back." Let's pray. Father, thank you for the story of Joseph. Lord, may we learn the lessons he learned to recognize when we go through tough times that we can look for ways you are refining us, that we can look for ways and things in our lives that need to be changed, that by your grace and by your power you can change, that we can look for ways you're preparing us to serve others. Father, when people ask us and point to our accomplishments, may we ever be reminded that whatever we do, we must give glory to you. We thank and praise you in Jesus' name. Amen.